we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello.
Busy week. I'm not even going to joke with you, okay?
Well, I have one suggestion, okay. which is how be we give CNN a half hour on Saturday morning and we just take over the 24-hour news network.
I like that.
Yeah, I think we might work all this stuff in.
Get the paperwork moving on that. So yesterday, I understand even some of the major networks covered it shortly thereafter. Hans Blix before the United Nations.
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
Yes. Hans Blix and Mohamed El-Baradei made their statements yesterday to the UN, the second report. And it was going to initially be a closed Security Council session, and then Germany and France pushed for an open session with the media present so that more people could actually hear the presentation, and they were successful.
And aren't we glad?
Yes, we are. Because if it had been a closed session, then there would have been a lot of pressure put on France in particular to go along with the U.S. and Britain. And this move made it pretty much impossible for that to happen.
And I think there also would have been quite a bit more misrepresentation of how the session actually played out in U.S. media.
And
there would have been more reports
content of that.
It was a mixed report, and it was not mixed at all.
No, it was not. It was profoundly positive for Iraq. And Blix and El-Baradei said, basically, that Iraq is now complying in substance as well as process. And I'll just read for you some of the things that Iraq is doing that Blix emphasized. Iraq is providing a list of people involved in destroying chemical munitions so they can be interviewed. They're surrendering more documents on their chemical and biological warfare program. They're allowing private interviews with Iraqi scientists. They're enacting legislation, and on Friday, Saddam Hussein issued a presidential decree to prohibit weapons of mass destruction, something that the UN has been pressing them to do for a while.
A number of years, actually.
Oh, yeah. They're allowing complete access to all their sites they have all along, all military industrial sites, the presidential palaces, and even private homes. They declared in their December report the one weapon program that has been found to violate the UN resolutions, and that's their Al-Samud missile program, which just barely violates the fly limit. The distance limit set by the United Nations.
And that distance limit is 93 miles. Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly limited limit.
So it's a very limited distance. And Iraq is now allowing U-2 surveillance flights. They are negotiating how those flights are going to occur. And they will also allow other UN aircraft to fly, including helicopters, French Mirage jets, German drones, and Russian Antonov planes, which have night vision capability. So it's not just American U-2s that will be making flights over Iraq. And finally, they are meeting with the South African team to discuss how South Africa was able to decommission their weapons of mass destruction programs to the satisfaction of the UN and the international community. So those are all steps that were outlined by Blix and El-Baradei that Iraq is doing, and they are pretty much complying with all the demands so far that the UN have made. So what we had was that Blix and El-Baradei had stressed that they had found no evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or of any weapons of mass destruction programs being revived or being continued.
And the subcontext of that, politically, certainly in terms of how the rest of the world is concerned, is that it is also a tremendous testimonial to the effectiveness of the inspections program itself in getting Iraq to back off on some of the things that have been developed over the past 4 years, where they are now, as opposed to where they were 3 or 4 months ago. The weapons inspectors are characterizing this as having substantially caught up for all of the time that had been missed over the past 4 years, that Iraq is now current with that inspections regime.
And both Blix and El-Baradei asked, and indeed this is the second or perhaps the third time that they have asked for more support for the inspectors, and they also included in their report a statement that was directly aimed at the United States and at Britain, requesting that all UN member nations that have any intelligence on weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq to surrender that information to the UN weapons inspectors. And that's specifically aimed at the United States because there's some question about the U.S. withholding information.
Yeah, as well as Blix having stated, and this was part also of the debunking of Colin Powell's presentation, which we'll get to, that the intelligence that they had received from the United States and from Britain, at least that part of it that wasn't clipped out of academic journals from 1991, that the intelligence they've gotten from the U.S. and Britain, by and large, have been dry, that they have inspected those sites and have found virtually nothing at any of them.
Right, and getting back to the U.S. sharing data, and the one hand, Powell saying that these things are being moved around, you know, via trucks and stuff, yet when the U.N. is asking for, you know, the data to back that up, or access to the live coverage from planes and or whatever intelligence.
Or even the satellite photos that prove that
right,
it's being moved.
The U.S.
Yeah.
hasn't been forthcoming with that. So,
yeah, and one of the things Blix also said, and we're starting to get into the debunking, is that they have also seen no evidence that any of the inspections of those sites have been anticipated by the Iraqi regimes, that as far as they can tell, all those inspections have been unexpected.
A complete surprise to the people there.
So, what was the different UN members' reactions to this?
No, it was amazing. I mean, first you had Syria standing up and saying that really, you know, we've got another nation in the region that has numerous weapons of mass destructions, particularly nuclear weapons, and that's Israel. And Israel has violated numerous UN resolutions, and yet we're concentrating on Iraq. What's going on here?
And then, has a weapons of mass destruction program that has consistently refused international inspection.
Exactly.
As well.
And then after Syria was done, you had France getting up, and the French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin giving a speech about peace and supporting the weapons inspectors and giving them more help and training more people to go there and do their job. And that was followed by a round of applause from everyone in the chamber. That is very, very, very unusual. I mean, that never happens in the UN.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that happened on the floor of the General Assembly yesterday that are extremely rare for the UN. One was both Blix and Alberdi getting up, and basically, in so many words, I mean, the diplomatic tone at the UN is very, very underscored. And for all the nonsense you hear about from U.S. from U.S. media about how Colin Powell brought an air of leadership and dignity and so forth, that room is full of people who, in their respective countries, are among the most accomplished people in their countries. They're all leaders. They're all highly intelligent, accomplished people, or most of them anyway. And, you know, it's a very understated and very respectful, you know, decorum is very highly valued. So you had two things that happened. One is that you had Hans Blix and Alberdi both getting up and essentially, in so many words, calling Colin Powell and the United States delegation liars, saying that Colin Powell's evidence did not add up. Then Colin Powell's evidence and his presentation last week was at best misleading, at worst did not at all match the experience of the inspectors on the ground. And that it you know, they basically issued a rebuttal to Colin Powell's presentation last week. That in itself was highly unusual. And then the response to the French speech, also highly, highly unusual. You do not have that entire chamber bursting into applause. And at this point, you have to say it's not Iraq that is facing diplomatic isolation around the world. It is the United States that's facing diplomatic isolation around the world, specifically the Bush administration. And if anybody is to be considered the rogue nation that presents a threat to world peace and world stability, it is not Iraq, it is the United States. And that is, I mean, that's not just Maria and I talking on this program. That's the viewpoint of many of this world's governments, including many of the United States' own allies and military allies. And instead, you have the Bush administration hawks issuing stupid, you know, schoolyard bullying, browbeating type statements about the inadequacy of our allies. It's just simply embarrassing.
Show some backbone, which is embarrassing. I mean, I looked at that and I laughed. Show some backbone. They are showing backbone. They're standing up to the U.S.
To the world's last remaining superpower. Moving along, Donald Rumsfeld was before several committees this week.
Yeah, he was. The Bush administration finds itself in a real box right now. It is rapidly facing a decision where if it's going to invade Iraq, it's going to have to do so without the support of the rest of the world. It has becoming very clear that the Bush administration is not going to be able to convince not just France and Russia and Germany on the Security Council that invading Iraq is a bad idea. But, despite its inducements to allow or at least not object to troop movements and the buying off of various Middle Eastern governments, despite that campaign, which has been going on for a year now, most of the governments of the world and of that region and among U.S. allies think it's a bad idea. And the vast majority of the public in most of these countries, up to, I believe, 88% was the latest opinion poll in Turkey, very, very high levels of objection throughout Europe and throughout much of the rest of the world, actually. And, of course, we'll get to this shortly. Also, there's massive demonstrations going on all over the world today, including here in Seattle. We'll talk about that a bit later, too. So you have all of these objections going on in the rest of the world, but the Bush administration is also facing a sales job here at home, and not just with us in the public, but there's also getting to be more and more skepticism on Capitol Hill. And in that context, the Bush administration has really been putting its foot on it in it all week long. You had Donald Rumsfeld making some rather awkward and embarrassing comments in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee earlier this week, where he started talking about the U.S. Military's need to use non-lethal chemical agents on the battlefield in Iraq. And as it turns out, many of these non-lethal chemical agents that the U.S. is proposing using in order to make the enemy sleepy or lethargic or less able to withstand U.S. attacks when they come, violate the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention Treaty and several other treaties on chemical and biological weapons that the United States is a signatory to, as well as some that it has not signed. So you had Donald Rumsfeld talking about a war that the United States is virtually alone in wanting to prosecute anywhere in the world, that it's doing so using at least the fig leaf of claiming that Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction, particularly chemical and biological agents. And you have Donald Rumsfeld admitting that the U.S. is prepared in turn in that war to use chemical agents that violate some of the same treaties that it is claiming that Iraq is in violation of. And you have Donald Rumsfeld in front of God and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and CCMN viewers and everybody else just sort of hemming and hawing and calling this, quote, a very awkward situation. it really is staggering the levels of hypocrisy that are going on in Washington, D.C. right now. You also had the rather embarrassing admission that the Code Orange, which can be seen as a fairly thinly veiled effort by the Bush administration to get the public, sufficiently terrified that it will have greater support for a war. And a couple things for that. Number one, the very bellicose stance by the U.S. government is all but guaranteed to provoke some kind of a response from the Islamic world, both the moderates and, of course, the more dangerous response from terrorist and fundamentalist types. But if the U.S. Launches an invasion of Iraq, you can be sure that there will be counterattacks. There will be counterattacks against Americans and American interests overseas, against allied interests overseas, and probably on the U.S. soil as well. It's what makes things like the sequel to the Patriot Act, which we talked about on this program last week, so dangerous, and the political climate so dangerous, because the Bush administration is trying to prepare the American public to be supportive of its actions when those counterattacks occur. And you can talk about Code Orange all you want, but the danger has always been there. The Bush administration is creating much of the danger. And then, as it turns out, the specific threat, which was purportedly one of the major contributing factors to calling the Code Orange and having the armed military presence in New York and D.C. and everywhere else, turns out to have been the invention of a captured Al-Qaeda leader who was dissembling to try and curry favor with with his American captors. And as Maria mentioned off air a little while ago, we don't know whether that person was tortured or not. For example, we do know, however, that this has been a fairly consistent problem. It's been very much a problem in Guantanamo Bay. It's been a problem all along that the Bush administration is using what it wants to hear from these people after they're captured and using it for building support for its own agendas.
One of the interesting things I heard in Rumsfeld's talk before the Armed Services Committee this week was two things that weren't connected, unfortunately, by the people questioning him. One was the fact that he wanted to remove the requirements on weapons that they necessarily have to be fully tested before they begin to use them in the field. He used the example of the Predator that they used in Afghanistan, that it had been something that was pretty much off the shelf and they decided to just use it live.
Yeah, or the undepleted uranium that has been used in Afghanistan. Yeah.
But and then later, he was getting questioned about, he had mentioned that, oh, and we want to start doing testing again on nuclear weapons, specifically the ones for bunker busting, things like that. And Kennedy was questioning him about that, and he said, oh, don't worry, you know, we just want to test these out. We don't necessarily want to use them. And
there,
if you jump to the fact that they want to test these in the field now, you got a pretty bad
equation. There has been a lot of open talk by hawks within the Bush administration on using particularly the busting. I got to put my tongue in at least once on this show every week. Using these weapons in the field in Iraq, a real desire to do so. And every U.S. intervention we've seen over the last 12 years, we saw it in Panama, we saw it in the first Gulf War, we saw it in Kosovo, we saw it in Afghanistan. We're going to see it again in Iraq if it comes to that. The U.S. has been testing out new generations of weapons to really catastrophic result on often very civilian populations and on American soldiers as well.
All right. Well, sticking with the theme of elected officials asking questions, Carl Levin was
Senator Carl Levin, who's a Senator Carl Levin, who's a Democrat from Michigan. He also has been part of some of the Armed Services and Intelligence Committees. He accused the CIA and the Bush administration of withholding crucial information from the UN inspectors and sabotaging the weapons inspection program. Now, he cited classified letters that he had obtained from the CIA. He didn't say how he had obtained them and whether or not it was dissatisfied CIA employees who passed them on to him, but he cited these letters that showed that the CIA had withheld specific information about, quote, a large number of sites of significant value. And he said that this proves that the CIA director George Tenet was lying when he told an Armed Services Committee on Tuesday of this week that the CIA had given UN inspectors all the information that it had on high and moderate interest locations inside Iraq. Now, notably, when Tenet came out of that meeting and was questioned by reporters who probably have more facts at their fingertips than some of the senators in the committee that Tenet just made his presentation to, Tenet admitted that, I was mistaken. There was some important information that was withheld. So,
all right. Moving along, the Iraqi exiles are also
I think it's interesting. We've got people going out to protest this today and yesterday. There were 200,000 in Melbourne yesterday and 6,000 in Tokyo and another 6,000 people on the street in Manila.
And it's sort of like New Year's as you watch it go around the globe with the time zone changes. We're now seeing the protests going around the globe. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not just people on the street who are protesting. Also, the Iraqi exiles are starting to get very, very, very angry at the Bush administration for two reasons. There were two items that leaked this week. One was Bush's special envoy to the Iraqi exile, Zalmay Khalilzad, the same guy who was the envoy to the Afghan exiles.
And look what a bang-up job they did with those folks.
Yeah, he's been looking around for somebody to sort of fulfill a Hamid Karzai role in Iraq. And the person he's currently wooing is an 80-year-old Iraqi exile whose name is Adnan Pachachi. And Adnan Pachachi is a Sunni Muslim, first of all, who's it means he's a member of the same minority group that Saddam Hussein is, and they are definitely a minority in Iraq, and that's making the Iraqi exiles angry because they're assuming that the Bush administration would take Pachachi and put him on top of basically Saddam's whole infrastructure and not make a single change.
And many of the exiles, many of the dissidents in Iraq are from the Shiite majority that have been repressed by Saddam.
Right. Pachachi has other things going against him. He was a former foreign minister and ambassador from Iraq to the UN. He declared in 1961 that Kuwait was a part of Iraq and had no right to exist independently. Furthermore, Pachachi only renounced that statement about 3 years ago, so long after the Gulf War.
And long after Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait on the same pretext that Saddam was claiming as well that Kuwait was historically a province of Iraq, which it was prior to the British divvying up the region.
Right. So this has made a big uproar. This has brought on a big uproar within Kuwait, which is pretty upset about this, too. And the second item that leaked this week that's got Iraqi exiles really mad is an announcement that the Bush administration is planning, kind of vaguely planning, because they don't have any details worked out yet, to occupy Iraq for 2 years and put a U.S. general in control of the country and to keep in place much of Saddam Hussein's infrastructure. Now, the Iraqi exiles have been hoping for and working towards a situation that's similar to what Afghanistan had, a council and elections, and they're very afraid that that's not what they're going to get from this Bush administration.
Yeah, and in fact, you had you had testimony this week in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in which the senators found out again, and many of them, especially the Democrats, were pretty visibly appalled by this, that the Bush administration has no detailed plans for even the transition to that scenario after a presumed military occupation or military victory in Iraq. And keep in mind also that Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, you're facing the very real prospect of continuing pockets of resistance, not just in the rural areas, but especially in the urban areas in places like Basra and especially Baghdad, if there is an American occupation, and especially if the Americans are directly ruling it, as they are now proposing to do.
You had some other resistance this week, too, from Turkey, who refused to put its soldiers in northern Iraq under U.S. command. Now, there's been some speculation, too, that if the U.S. invades Iraq and a war gets started and Saddam Hussein is overthrown, that Iraq will disintegrate into three or more separate entities. I can tell you that Turkey is certainly considering taking control of northern Iraq. It would like to have all of Kurdish territory under its control.
Which the Kurds are terrified of.
Exactly.
Because of Turkey's repression and, in fact, in many cases, outright genocide, certainly mass human rights violations of the Kurdish population that's under Turkish control. Kurdistan, traditional Kurdistan, is the largest territory in the world in which a clearly defined ethnic, religious, cultural, lingual group does not have its own country. A big portion of it's in Iraq. A big portion of it's in Turkey. There are also portions in Iran and Syria. And all of those countries are opposed to the idea that the Kurds might have their own country.
All right. Moving along. It's amazing how the Osama tapes come out just in time, right before we go in someplace.
Yeah, and it was also amazing that the U.S. media, I guess I shouldn't be amazed by the uncritical acceptance by the U.S. media at this point of what the Bush administration says, but how the Bush administration, with a straight face, can say that Osama bin Laden calling upon Iraqis to resist the American aggressors is evidence that Iraq and Osama are in league together. I mean, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were citing the American sanctions against Iraq as one of the three major reasons for its jihad against the Americans, in 1991. It has been consistently saying that the Americans have been out of line and out of line specifically in what it does to the Iraqi civilians, even though there is no love lost between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's government for at least, for actually a number of years now. And it doesn't prove anything other than Osama bin Laden is consistent. But it's interesting that it came out at that time particularly, but it's also fascinating that, you know, you can wave the Osama bin Laden tape and all it becomes is more evidence for going after Saddam Hussein. Nobody is saying, I thought this is a war against terror and weren't these the guys that attacked New York? And nobody is certainly saying, hey, wait a minute, what about the pledge by George Bush, you know, a year and a half ago that we're going to get this guy dead and alive? How come everybody else seems to know where he is except us? It really is remarkable the extent to which the Bush administration has succeeded with its bait and switch to where we had to spend the last half hour talking about Iraq rather than talking about Al-Qaeda or any of the, you know, very legitimate threats to the security of the United States, let alone all of the domestic crises, many of which the Bush administration has a lot to do with perpetrating.
Yeah, I found it interesting that so far that looks like the tape has been debunked as being from Osama. On top of that, you look at the news coverage of it, and the fact that they all exclude the part that Osama called for the uprising within Iraq of overthrowing Saddam.
He called Saddam a whole bunch of names, particularly an infidel, which he has also called the United States the great infidel. So I mean.
And there are a couple things. Number one, the legitimacy of the tape itself is in question. And number two, I mean, there's not really very little on that tape that couldn't have been recorded 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to let people know about what was going on today and this weekend.
Yeah. If you didn't have enough reasons to get riled up and upset over the last half hour, you know, let us on the air for another 6 or 7 hours, and we'll get you annoyed. But there are protests going on all around the world today. Maria already mentioned some of them that have already taken place in the Pacific Basin. They are gradually moving their way westward across the Eurasian landmass and later on today into North America. They were expecting today, I saw yesterday that the mayor of London was saying that he'd be astonished if it was less than 500,000 and probably more like 1 million. The largest protest in UK history. They were also expecting 1 million in Rome today. They were expecting many, many tens or hundreds of thousands in Paris and Berlin and a number of other European cities. 100,000 or probably more in New York today, even though the police are not letting them march. And we're expecting a very large protest in Seattle here today as well. And if we can't do better than we've done in this city in a long, long time, I don't know what it'll take. But people should very much turn out because, you know, I really think that domestic pressure is the one key to preventing this travesty. The rest of the world is doing what they can, but we have to apply that pressure in our own communities as well. So.
Yeah, and for people who don't know where the demonstration is going on today, it's going to be at noon at the Seattle Center. Come early. Come on the bus if you can, because it's very hard to find parking in that part of the
best of circumstances,
city.
It's hard to find parking down there. Yeah.
Yeah. Use our wonderful bus system. Bring a friend, bring some family, bring your kids, bring whoever, but show up. I know it's probably going to rain today, so dress warm and wear a raincoat.
Yep. Layers is the key.
Yeah, and you will work up a little bit of warmth later on because there's going to be a march after we have the rally at noon. It will be through downtown and on down to the INS detention facility.
They estimate about 2 miles.
Yeah, it's about 2 miles going through downtown. And, you know, it is important to remember because we've spent the last half hour talking about the foreign affairs portion of this, but this war on terror is having some domestic victims as well, and that connection is going to be made pretty explicitly here in Seattle today, and I'm very glad to see that.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time. Talking once again to John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell us, where do people find Eat the State?
It is more important than ever to support independent media, including this fine program and radio station, and including also Eat the State, which is a volunteer newspaper that comes out every couple weeks here in Seattle. It is free of charge. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and places around town where you hang up and pick up free publications, although no other one is as valuable as this one. You can also, maybe the coupons are, but you can also get it over the web at www.eatthestate.org. Eat the State is a very shoestring operation, which is pretty remarkable given how great it looks and how much wonderful information is in it, and how many talented people like us are in it. But it can definitely use your support. You can subscribe, $24 for a year, $45 for two. Additional donations more than welcome at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. We will be down at the protest today and with papers, and probably if hang around surreptitiously outside Seattle Center, because we wouldn't want to vend on public property, with T-shirts also and donations accepted and whatnot. And if you would like to volunteer, if you have story comments, ideas, feedback, we have a voicemail that operates 24 hours a day at area code 206-903-9461, and the website, again, eatthestate.org.